Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Grumpy Nostalgia. There's an adage adapted from a Thomas Wolfe novel that says you can't go home again, inferring that nostalgia causes us to view the past in an overly positive light. We tend to remember things in static terms, meaning if you try to return to a place you remember from the past, it won't be the same as you remember it. There's no reason that can't apply to pop culture. So for those of us that are born in the latter half of the 20th century, the proliferation of movies and video games and you name it, we've kind of built up our own kind of personal hard drive with nostalgic memories. We come from a generation that had to leave the house to go rent a movie from Blockbuster. For those of you that even know what a Blockbuster is, we did our gaming standing up in an arcade. So we tend to have a lot of memories about how great our life was back then. But the purpose of this show is to go back and look at those things and reconsider them, take off the rose-colored glasses and understand, is there any there? Is the stuff just good because we remember it as being good, our association or affinity to it, or is it just crap? So that hereby ends the arty part of this podcast. Now let's get to the crap. So we're going to look at some of our favorite movies, and on the premiere episode, we're going to look at a real doozy. So joining me is my BFF, Mike James. Say hello, Mike.
Howdy.
So without further ado, let's get right to it. So we decided we want to hit the ground running with a real doozy. Twister. Awesome. Everybody's favorite Twister. Mike, you said you love this movie, right?
Love is a strong word.
So let me tell you a little information about it, just to make you feel a little bit better about what we're going to put ourselves through here. Released in 1996, directed by Jan de Bont. Written by, of all people, Michael Crichton. I bet you didn't know that. And his wife at the time, Anne-Marie Martin, who at that time was previously famous for writing the TV show Sledgehammer, which is one of our favorites.
David Rash.
That's correct. Nice pull. And she also wrote Prom Night. So
Prom Night.
Take what you want out of that. They quickly divorced after this movie. And I'll let you fill in your own punchline there. But of course, he went on to do bigger and better things. He had a budget of $92 million.
I'd forgotten that Steven Spielberg was an executive producer on it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it probably would have been better if he had done it. Just go down the list of movies.
Was Jan de Bont part of his like stable of directors? Or
I don't know. I think he might have been a cinematographer for him at some point. Or in that, there's probably people that know more than us that are screaming at their.
That makes sense based on what I saw of the movie. The photography was.
Yeah, I mean, say what you want about this thing, but it was beautiful. It was incredibly well shot. The scenery was well framed and things you like. But so it went on to gross $241 million. So it was generally beloved by the movie public and critics.
Second best movie of the year.
Second. There he goes. Someone hit his Google machine too.
Shocking. I couldn't believe it beat out Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
It really was surprising.
Well, I have some theories about that. So 494 million worldwide. So, I mean, this thing was really big. I remember what the first time I saw it. It was at a suburban Chicago theater when they had just started inventing the multiplexes. I think this one was about, I think it featured 8 theaters, which was a huge deal back then. And I remember the biggest takeaway was the audience just really overwhelmed by it. And I think it helped that the trailer to Jurassic Park, The Lost World premiered there.
Wow.
And that just set the buzz for everybody. So the movie kind of had a nice little lead in, but that was before you had YouTube and everybody spilling trailers. You didn't know when trailers were going to hit. You didn't know what they were going to be attached to. It just really kind of sets tone. Where did you see this one, Mike, first time?
I saw it in, you know, in Charlotte, a little north of here. It had two theaters. It was the Arboretum Theater. And we saw it right after a thunderstorm, as a matter of fact, and our power went out. So the timing was coincidental and perfect. It's the first scene in the movie. We had nothing else to do. And my wife, who loves, we just married, and she's a big fan of disaster movies. And this was right up her alley.
Disasters in general, apparently.
Exactly. She loved it, you know, and I came out, I liked it. It was popcorn cinema for me, you know, it was action. So it had that part into it, you know, and like I said, it just, you know, it was a thing to do. And I guess they timed it to hit like the storm season in May. So it kind of worked out pretty good. And
strategic marketing. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, it was very, very, I don't know, you might know, obviously, you know more than I do about this stuff, but
that is correct.
I didn't know when they remembered, or started doing a May releases for summertime movies. Was this one of the first ones that did like that?
Yeah, I think the one that kind of broke the levee was Cliffhanger. I remember seeing that when college was still going, and that was like, they pitched that as like, summer comes early, and Stallone's hanging from those Italian Alps.
But
that's a good point. I forgot about that. Now there is no summer tentpole movie.
Okay,
I figured
it was a cash grab to get the money as early as possible for the summer season. And
it was probably to jump ahead of all the other better movies that were coming out that summer. But I'm with you. I saw it. You know, I was a 25-year-old bro who said, "Oh, that was awesome, man." But I think in hindsight, looking back at it, what was interesting is I think the entire culture, the public, was dope sick on CGI. Cause that was right. I think people would go see anything if there was CGI, after kind of Jurassic Park kind of kicked off the whole phenomena, people would go see anything. Like we saw the Scorpion King because there was CGI in it.
That's right. Oh, that CGI was awesome.
Badge of honor. but I think the entire country was just kind of obsessed with this new technology and kind of fell in love with it. So they kind of gave movies like this. It's probably just the cigarettes as a delivery vehicle for nicotine. I think this movie was just the delivery vehicle
for the
CGI.
Effects. I did see it. Industrial Light and Magic was behind the effects, and they are truly stunning. I mean, you look at the tornado and the effects of just showing the motion of it going through a cornfield was
Mike. Don't no spoilers. We can't talk about tornadoes.
Oh, sorry.
In this movie.
Sorry. I thought we were. Spoiler zone. Sorry.
No, you're right. They completely hold up. I mean, they were just. I mean, to this day, they look great. But you know what doesn't hold up? the cast. So interesting. I was looking at some research on this movie and just a few things about it. Tom Hanks was the originally scheduled cast to play Joe. Or no, not Joe. That's the female.
Bill.
Bill. Yeah.
Bill Pullman. Paxton playing
whatever,
Bill.
Whichever one you want to choose there.
Yes.
Yeah, he was the first choice, but he ultimately dropped out. And then Joss Whedon was coming to do. He was in here as a script doctor whenever before those things even existed.
Oh, that's in my notes. I had no idea he was cutting this movie. Oh my gosh.
So he had to end up leaving with bronchitis. so they just figured out how to get by with what they had. But apparently, James Cameron, Robert Zemeckis, you mentioned Spielberg, they were all in the running to want to direct this thing.
Wow.
So I think Spielberg mostly for his affiliation or collaboration with Michael Crichton. But apparently Jan DeVont was a real nutcase. There was constant infighting on the set. He hated all the actors. He couldn't wait to go direct Godzilla. He hated the entire cast. And they didn't care for him either.
He'd rather deal with Matthew Broderick. Okay, well,
yeah,
fair enough.
So we mentioned the cast. So Bill Paxton played Bill. Helen Hunt of Mad About You fame was the lead Joe. Cary Elwes as evil Dr. Jonas.
Yes, evil.
Jamie Gertz is there as Joe's fiance and basically just an exposition device, and we'll get to that in a minute. And the great Philip Seymour Hoffman, I don't know if this is his first role, but
I didn't look that up. Although I thought of the Whack Pack, you know, the group of, you know, kids or whatever. He was obviously the best. He stood out. I mean,
you know, my memories of him were much more douchey, but he actually he wasn't that bad in this movie, to be honest. He was actually real comic relief, I guess, if you want to call that.
Yeah, I mean,
he pulled it off where all the others were assigned to do it, and they botched it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to go for the quirkiest member of the pack, you know, he obviously was that guy. Yeah. And, you know, if Joss Whedon, just finding this out, if his dialogue was behind it, then he executed his assigned chores perfectly.
It's starting to add up here. Uh-huh. Yeah, and you mentioned the cast of characters, which is an assemblage of,
yes.
Hey, it's that guy from That Thing. Probably one of the greatest examples in film history. There's at least a dozen people here you've seen from something else, but you don't know their names. But when they had the scene, they sure chewed the heck out of it. That's for sure. So
exactly. Yeah. I was amazed at how it was almost a competition to see, okay, who can be quirky.
Yeah.
Like the professor guy. I don't even know what his actor's name was. I don't remember anything he was in, but he was obviously just in there to be this, I don't know.
Oh, I love that guy.
And quirk.
We'll get to his story here in a little bit, because I found just a juicy nugget that I enjoyed out of that guy. All right, so let's just do a quick review. So movie opens up in, I think, 1969 in rural Oklahoma. And you see the, you know, the standard tropes of, you know, ominous weather coming and all that kind of thing. And then it's Joe's family back in the day, and she's just a little girl. And, of course, there's a Toto dog.
Yes.
Just really ham-fisted way to kind of show that Wizard of Oz connecting. So anyway, so their first instinct is to go into the storm cellar, which, of course, is in the middle of the yard and nowhere attached to the house.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that Midwest.
I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in the Midwest, and more often than not, you know, the safety vesicle is, you know, attached to the house somewhere where it's safe, not in the middle.
A root cellar, you know,
of an open field. So, you know, they run to the rooms, the storm cellar, and of course, you know, the twister's coming and it's growling for some reason. I don't know how that works. So they jump in, and, you know, Dad, when he built this thing, had no concept of 3/4-inch plywood or heavy bolts.
He's the weakest bolt you could ever find.
It's a latch for a screen door. So, of course, he gets pulled out and sucked away, and that's when they really kind of establish one thing, that the movie has disbanded all aspects of physics whatsoever, so you don't have to worry about that anymore. They've just taken that off your plate for you. Pretty sure, you know, the pickle jars on the shelf don't even but there goes Dad.
Why did he have to hold on to the door? Obviously the mom and the daughter were fine down where they were.
Could have pitched in, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like hold his leg or something. It's background story. I wasn't too worried about the flaw there.
We get the idea. So Joe's traumatized by twisters, so of course he gets a job dealing with twisters. So switch cut to present day. They kind of overlap the NSSL. And that's, again, another kind of stereotypical, they're all just at their desk drinking coffee saying it's gonna be a long day. And all these storms are lining up. It's the perfect storm.
Yes.
So they kind of set the premise that there's some science in this movie, but you don't have to worry yourselves with that.
This is a real organization, by the way. So
I was surprised
to look that up. It was actually a real thing.
Oh.
Yeah, NSSL.
And apparently they only have... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say they actually do have an organization that, you know, analyzes weather conditions in the Midwest. So,
wow.
Shocking.
It's probably because of this movie. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. So the opening shot, you know, you get this whimsical John Williams type music of the Bill driving his truck across the plains. Apparently there's a backstory there that Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt are getting in the middle of divorce. So this is before, I guess, fax machines or anything were invented. So he has to drive out to the middle of Oklahoma to get her to sign the papers, which he's reluctant to do, suggesting that she still got it in for old Bill. Mm-hmm. So we've got Jamie Gertz in the car with him as his fiance. So Jamie's basically us the dumb audience that doesn't know anything about the whole topic. So she's there just to be explained things to. So they really lay on the heavy exposition in these first few scenes here.
And we get to see the crew too.
Yeah. And we also get introduced to Joe dropping an F-bomb as one of her first line of dialogue in a PG-13 movie.
Oh, didn't even notice that. So Jamie Gertz all grown up.
Yeah. No, it's Helen Hunt said the F-bomb.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So, hey, you know, take your kids to the matinee to see a summer blockbuster and have them mad about you, lady, cussing at them. But hey, whatever. So that's where we get introduced to all, as you mentioned, all the team and how cute they are. And then, so you establish all this exposition, what's going on that day. They have a backstory, romantic backstory, which is tacked on. And then, boom, without even knowing it, the twister scenes start kicking in. The first thing I thought of was the Spielberg line. You ever saw the shark in the first reel? They just abandoned that altogether.
Yeah.
At this point, the plot summary is kind of redundant, but it's just a series of one tornado after the other.
Yeah, I had forgotten when I first saw it that this all took place in like a basically 24-hour period.
Yeah, but they don't do a very good job capturing that because, you know, they show up at Aunt Meg's farm for breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
But there's no nighttime. So where do they all sleep? But
Oh yeah, for that scene. You think they're there for the day, or they're just there for a couple hours and they get the next call?
I don't know. Because
they're at the drive-in theater at night, and I thought that's and they actually have a hotel room for Bill and his fiance.
I think the thing takes over the course of like 3 or 4 days, but
okay,
it's
okay.
Just the way they edited it and chopped it together. It's really more about plot convenience than I think of anything, story structure.
Just advancing to the next set piece,
yeah,
kind of thing.
That's what it is. It's just a way to move to the next tornado. So the first one, we start to see the CGI, which is cool, but we also get introduced to the bad guys. And of course, they're all driving black Ford Explorers.
They have corporate sponsorship, too.
Yeah, and I thought that was funny that Bill resents the fact that Jonas got corporate sponsors. Because who wants corporations donating money to science?
How dare you. Now, they never explicitly say it. They have a couple of decals in some of the equipment, but I guess our ragtag group, they're funded by a university.
Yeah, I think that's okay. I think that's what they were.
But they never actually say it. I'm like, well, obviously they're funded, but I don't know if this, kids are supposed to be like doctoral candidates or master's degree students,
in weather
or meteorology.
Kind of diminishes the how important their process is. They don't tell you who's behind it. They're just amateurs that they just we digress.
Sorry.
But what I thought was interesting is about Cary Elwes in his accent.
I got that right here.
Well, yeah, as a son of the South yourself, Mike, I'm sure you have some.
I thought Bill Paxton had the only authentic accent. That and the ER guy that shows up later. He must have been a local. They seem to have the only authentic accents I noticed in the movie. The Jamie Gertz accent, oh my goodness. I don't know where that was from. She must have watched Vivian Leigh too much. I don't know. It had such a where did she come from kind of vibe to it. I have no idea.
I think we've had this conversation in the past, but I know as a Southerner born and bred that you must have this a tremendous amount of frustration with Hollywood, because anytime they assign an accent to anybody, it's always one accent. Living in the South for 20 or so years now, I understand there's layered dialects, the Southern language, and but Hollywood thinks it's Ernest or Jim Varney. There's only one. And especially, I guess, it's odd that, the dialect kind of drifts on and off. Sometimes he has it, sometimes he doesn't.
Right. Oh, yeah. He and Jamie Gertz are probably the top two offenders in the movie, but I don't even think the other characters tried to pull off. They just went with the flat Missouri, accent. You know what I mean? I don't know where Helen Hunt's from, but it wasn't a distraction as much as like hearing Jamie Gertz and Cary Elwes like say his lines. It was like,
I'm telling you, it's really, the, man?
I'll just call him Dr. Jonas. We'll just call him Dr. Jonas.
Yeah. So anyway, they show up and they express their dominance by running off the road, chasing the twister. And so it's just kind of this diametrically opposed approach to the good guys and the bad guys, which, you know, those, you know, I don't think the rivalries in the academia world are that fierce, but especially when they're dealing with something is, and that's another theme, that how trivial do they make all this? This is serious crap. You know, people die from this all the time.
Oh, researchers. It's remember, Justin, as Bill Paxton tells Dr. Jonas, this is not a game. I wrote that line down. I circled it. I could not believe he just said that after all we had seen of them basically being like tornado cowboys.
Yeah.
And he comes up with this line. Oh, hey, you need to get away from there. This is not a game. I was like,
this is coming from the guy that was called the extreme. Did you get as many chills as I did when Dusty's telling that story about the extreme?
Oh yes.
I had to hit pause and kind of walk away and take a lap and reset because, I had to put a sweater on because of the chills on that one for sure.
Well, yeah, you did. That was a tough one. That and the different little names they had for tornadoes. Did you notice all the different little terms? I don't know if these are actual.
They threw a lot of jargon. A lot of jargon out there.
We had drunkard. We had sisters.
Yeah, yeah.
Barn burner.
Barn burner. Face. I like that one. Yeah, yeah.
And then the cone of silence.
Don't forget the suck zone.
Oh yeah, suck zone. And I'm punching the core. Don't forget to punch the core.
Yeah, yeah. But they just ran all that stuff out for a script that took a third of its movie just for exposition. You'd think they'd like throw us a bone and say what that means. But anyway,
No. But yeah, back to your original point about like just almost they. I didn't the Jamie Gertz character. You're supposed to feel. Not bad for, but you're supposed to almost point and laugh at her. Oh, look, she got scared because they were in the middle of two tornadoes and the truck spun around.
Exactly. She had the nerve to be intimidated by this horrible force of nature that can kill you.
Yes, yes. And later on go ahead.
I actually wrote a note. There's a point like after the third or fourth tornado chase scene. I think it's after the tornado that the drive-in. She goes, this is not okay.
Yeah.
I thought that's the first real line of dialogue I've heard from anybody. It came from her, of all people.
Yeah. Yeah. And when they're in that pit trying to like dodge hubcaps and signs from the drive-in theater, it's like, she's screaming. Everybody else is just kind of staring. And, you know, you got Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton exchanging looks like, oh, she's, I don't know why she's scared.
What's wrong with her? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, dude. Literally, you got like weapons flying at you, and you're supposed to be okay with this.
So, my opinion, everything on this movie, this is where everything turns in the movie, is the drive-in movie scene. First of all, we get our first chance of looking at a good movie. So you got The Shining's on the screen.
I wish I was one of those kids in the car.
I thought it was ironic that the most iconic scenes in the movie are always on the screen as the worst parts are happening. Like Jack's literally saying, here's Johnny, as the screen gets ripped away. Like, we get it. It's The Shining. We get it. But you mentioned one of the cast of characters, the guy with the beard that looks like every college English professor you've ever
had. Oh, yeah, the professor.
Yeah, I took a certain amount of schadenfreude here because when, the special effects were amazing, but I thought the hubcap thing was straight out of Plan 9 and Outer Space. You could see the string. He gets bonked in the head. Yeah, by one of these Captain America style flying things. And his response is just, it's so touching. He gets held by Joe and he grabs his head. And he goes, my head. Like a borscht belt comedian. It's so funny.
And the blank stare. That's what got me. It was just, I actually thought that the top of his head had been sliced off and they just didn't show it.
Then we'd get, then you'd have something. And one of these guys probably needed to die, but of course they stuck that with the villains because it's morality play at the end of the
poor day. Eddie. Oh, Eddie.
Yeah. So what happened? Oh. So Eddie's accent drifted in and off. That's Dr. Jonas's right hand man. He's the one that wanted to help them, and you know he got shot down. When I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. Was the response there? And so he had an. If you notice, he had a slight accent that drifted in and out.
Yeah, you're right. That was another thing I wrote down was the bad guys, corporate goons. You know, that pack was not really fully fleshed out. I didn't even know that Jake Busey was in this movie until I saw the credits, and I was like, oh wait, yeah, he must have been one of the Dr. Jonas.
Must have been one of the guys. Yeah, the henchmen.
Goons.
Yeah,
yeah. And yeah. I never saw him. And like I said, I didn't even notice. You know, some of their dialogue is just obvious.
Yeah.
Just. I don't even, you know, just to show us that, here's his team.
Yeah, I think those guys are just there to get killed, so you don't have to feel bad about the good guys getting killed. You know, so they had to express the seriousness of these things in some way. Why not kill off the bad guys and check a morality play checkbox in the room? So towards the end, they're at their last legs, and they go to Aunt Meg's house and eat a 50,000 calorie steak and eggs meal. And they tack on one last little bit of exposition and really kind of forecast the last act.
Yes, I got it right here.
Yeah.
The F5 mentioned. Right when they're eating there in that meal.
Can't say that. It's like Voldemort.
Yeah, it's like everybody gets quiet. Now, because all Jamie Gertz is just legitimately asking, hey, y'all ever seen an F5? Mic drop.
You mean the finger of God? Is it the finger of God or the hand of God?
It doesn't
matter.
Only one of them has actually seen it. So, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course it's Joe. And so that just kind of sets up the final act, which is these guys chasing the Moby Dick, so to speak. And it's interesting because, you know, of course Meg gets it, you know, and after Meg's farm gets crashed.
Yes.
Now it's personal. You know, now they're gonna get it done.
They had no warning, Justin.
They had no warning except for the tornado warning, but whatever. So as they're picking up the carnage and trying to get, you know, Aunt May or Meg, I don't know.
Meg.
Yeah. Again, another character actress that you don't know her name, but she's been in everything. So Joe notices her wind chimes and starts to she has the aha moment that Dorothy, which is the test module that they want to put into the hurricane and get all the sensors up in the core and feedback data, she realized that they have to build propellers and in a convenient
product placement
opportunity. Somehow they have 50,000 Pepsi product cans.
I told Lydia that when we were rewatching it. I'm like, wait a second. Who's drinking all these Pepsis in the back of this van, maybe? I don't know. In the station wagon? Professor Station Wagon. Maybe that's where it was.
So my theory is that they're all not long for this world. And so they eat steak and eggs and mashed potatoes for breakfast. And they're just living off beef jerky that they're, you know, going from gas and gulch to the next.
Cans of potato alone.
Yeah. And then they just got nothing but Mountain Dew and Pepsi in the coolers. So maybe that's why they're so, you know, anxious to meet their impending doom, because they're not long for this world anyway. I don't know. So they show like the standard movie trope where they, you know, it's the psych yourself up scene where they do the montage. Not one of which shows them like going through recycling bins or garbages to find all these cans.
And but they do but all this on a 1 hour ride, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah.
Where it goes from nighttime to all of a sudden late morning. And they're going 1 hour north of Wakita. And I'm trying to figure out the geography, but that, you know.
Yeah.
Minor flaw.
And like with scissors.
yes.
And I don't know if you ever, I've tried to cut cans. I've never done it without cutting and bleeding.
No.
I doubt I could do probably 4,000 or 5,000 in a row without getting damaged in some way.
Yeah, they're quite a crew.
But they figured it out. So, you know, Dorothy 2.0 is ready.
A nice touch is they actually showed just the hands of somebody doing it, and they had like a cut on their index finger.
Oh, did they? I didn't notice that.
Yes.
Nice catch.
Yeah,
nice
catch. I noticed that. I was like, wow, okay, so there's some realism there, you know?
Well, to be fair, I was watching Olympic curling on the other screen while I was watching this, and I was much more absorbed in that. So we're winding down to the end. They're getting excited. They're getting close to the F5. It's a mile wide. It's a mile wide, Mike.
Mile wide.
So the biggest one they've ever seen. And their natural instinct is to drive right at it. This is where the Satriani music kicks in.
Oh, yeah, yes. This was very noticeable to me this time seeing it than 26 years ago. The cuts from operatic kind of like, ooh,
yeah, you know, yeah.
Here's the big tornado to the Dooney, I'm going down the road with Van Halen.
To the Sammy Hagar, yeah.
Yeah, it's like...
I don't want those mixed.
This is kind of... It clashed, like I say.
Yeah.
You know, that whenever they show the convoy cutting through like some cornfields and dirt roads, you're like, yeah, this is great. Yeah, we're
moving. It had that John Williams feel with Jaws where they're chasing the shark. And then
the next thing you're looking up in the sky. Ooh, you know, here comes the opera music. You know, it's like... Yeah. It was a little... I don't know if those two genres mix very well in music.
No, especially when you go from that to the, you know, studio heavy, overproduced Sammy Hagar, yes. Van Halen stuff. But I guess that's just personal preference, Mike.
respect the wind.
Yeah.
Respect
the wind. So, but at some point they decide that, you know, this is kind of a serious thing. So this is where their Oscar moment, where they profess their love to each other, and they have to be serious and they have to go for it. And it's basically just Bill and Joe in their red truck with only had liability on it, Mike.
Oh, yes. Only liability.
What was the point of that? Anyway, it's that banter that I just really got to grate on me a little bit. I guess you don't know.
You think that was Joss? You think that's Joss Whedon infused?
Absolutely. From everything I've heard, it's got to be him.
And that was not to take your time out from your exposition here, but this is one of the first movies I remember seeing that had the kind of wacky exchanges between cast, like with this, you know, like I said, with the Whack Pack, and
yeah,
moments of almost humor when it's not
levity, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, just too much wit and just too many.
Just get to it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like, you know, this isn't Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know.
I think it would have been better, sir. It would have been more thrilling if you had some sort of, like, I keep going back to Jaws because this, a better version of this movie is Jaws, where. They have a scene where a bonding scene where, you know, Quint tells a story of the Indianapolis where they humanize each other and they understand what they're up against, you know, and they lose those boundaries they have, you know.
Yeah.
But you didn't have Quint out there making little, you know, silly little jokes, you know. You didn't need constant comic relief. They had a point where they established that, hey, this is serious and we need to get together.
Yeah,
but these guys never quite, you know, got that. So it just, to me, it's an adventure movie, sure, but at some point there's, you know, to sell the antagonist of the film here is nature, but they, you know, and I don't know, they don't really serve that except for a few scenes where people get killed, you know, because they're bad people, not so much they're, you know, they got killed because they're bad.
they're dumb. They didn't listen because they're too arrogant.
Because nature can spot hubris and go after that. So
that's right.
But anyway, so they end up strapping Dorothy 2 into the back of the truck. And then they just kind of do a, you know, kamikaze mission where they just drive the truck right into the thing, and then.
Oh, can I go back a couple minutes?
Oh yeah, yeah.
I hate to be cliche, but the jump the shark moment where they actually drive the truck through a house that is falling to the road. Oh my gosh!
And he says, "We're going in. We're going in."
Yeah, and my believability in this movie was actually was. Except
it's hanging, by a thread.
Except for the witty batter, the banter. The science made sense to that point.
Yeah.
Then, you know, even the special effects, you know, cars being tossed around.
Yeah.
But when they went to the house, I know. All respect. There was only 10 minutes ago in the movie, but when that happened, you lost me.
I have the same notes, same observation. I literally wrote, house equals jump shark.
There you go. Yeah. How about that?
But
I like I said, I couldn't abide by that scene.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to your comic.
So yeah, so they drive into the they bail out, they drive in, the Dorothy works, all the little modules get sucked up and they're getting information, and they realize that they just drove a truck in there and they have no way out. So of course they go to the place that has the most sharp instruments and dangerous tools. They hide there and they anchor themselves down with JC Penney belts into a rusty old farm pipe, and it blows away, and they make it, and it starts raining and they're soaking wet and they're holding each other and they love each other and everything is
and the
good.
Crew shows, don't forget the crew, they show up right in time.
Oh yeah, right on time. Yeah,
just all the instruments are working, all the information is being downloaded and everything worked.
And they're gonna start their new lab and they're already with the, you know, they're already like Nick and Nora Charles and they're arguing about who's gonna run the lab and
yes.
But yeah, so happy ending, and the movie's over, and America loved it. And you know, it was
apparently
one of the. It was interesting. This is one of the first DVD titles ever published.
Oh wow!
And I bought it. I actually had this on Laserdisc because that's what kind of bro I was at the time.
Oh my goodness!
I have this on three different physical medias. Yeah.
Oh my god.
So it did end up winning a few Oscars, of course. You know, sound and visual effects for sure. It did
sense.
Win Best Picture though at the Nickelodeon Awards. So.
Not The Rock?
No. That was before The Rock took over the entire industry.
No, the movie The Rock. Came out in 96. If you look at the list of movies in 96, it's mind-blowing. Mind-blowing.
You know, you can say that about every year prior to, like, 2000. There were always...
That's true.
You go all the way back to, like, 1980, and you see the amount of, I guess during the course of this podcast, we'll fix some of those.
Watch that word quality.
Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting. You always had at least 10 or 12 tentpole movies that were, you know, oh yeah, that's great. And we'll get to each one of those, so don't worry. There was talk of a sequel. Helen Hunt wanted to make a sequel. She had pitched the idea, but she wanted like a multiracial cast. And she also wanted to get herself killed off in it. So a diverse cast and losing the star, I guess the Hollywood execs couldn't put that together.
Not 1996 was not ready for
that. Quite ready for that. But who knows? We could have got something amazing. Sure.
Wow.
But there you go. So
quick science question, Justin. I'm going to polish this off here. What science do you believe more? The Hank Hill episode where he's helping Luann's trailer get turned upright and they get caught in a tornado. And all of he's left outside the root cellar. All his clothes come off. Yeah. How do Bill Paxton's boots not come off during the last scene?
I'm going to stop you right there and say the Hank Hill version of the Twister is more accurate.
Even Helen Hunt's little headphones don't come off.
Don't even come off. Yeah, they missed a few things. Hank's pants would come off, and the lady next door would have saw a barrel of pickles. For those that don't know what you're talking about, do yourself a favor, go watch King of the Hill. They more accurately depict the Twister version. When Bobby threw the tested Dale Gribble's contingency that you could throw an egg through a brick wall.
Humpty's Revenge.
Humpty's
Revenge. I could have added that in them Twister movie.
So, of course, he throws the egg and it goes about 3 feet and goes right back into his face. And it's just a throwaway joke. So what's even better about that? But yeah, much more scientifically accurate depiction of a tornado for sure. Through an animated, that's the word, right? Animated show.
Animated, yes, sir.
But yeah, so that's Twister. Like I said, everybody loves it. I loved it at the time. So now we get to the end of our show where we kind of look at we rate these movies before we saw them and then we grump them down with the grumpy meter. So I'll go first, Mike. I would say on a 5-star rating, I gave this a 4.5 when going into it.
Wow.
My first viewing of it, because of the very reasons it was cutting edge technology. You know, we were younger, we were less cynical. We didn't care about plot development or things like that. It didn't matter. It was a roller coaster. And those are the memories that I have associated or affiliated with this movie. However, being a broken down fanboy with a more cynical attitude and the Statler and Waldorf syndrome that we currently have, rewatching this was a little tough. So I'm going to grump this down to about a 2-star movie. That's my grump rating because substance matters a little bit to those of us that don't have it. And this movie it's still fun. It doesn't change whether I'll watch it again. I'll still watch it when it's on. But if I had to look at it for art, I'm about middle of the range on that one. How about you?
I'm going to surprise you by telling you I actually went up half a star. I initially, when I saw this movie, I I knew what it was going into it. I'd seen the trailer with the stupid cow and then the line about, oh, it's the same cow. You know, remember? And of course, that was in every damn trailer. And that and the fact I just did not want to see, you know, some of these. I wasn't a big Helen Hunt fan. I hated the Mad About You show. So
yeah.
That going in, I kind of was jaded. Movie kind of proved that when I watched it, and effects were great, sure.
Yeah.
But at the time, I thought it was about an average movie, 2.5 stars. Watching it this time, totally different. I would a lot of appreciation for the effects. I mean, thinking that this is 96, you look at it now, those hold up great. I was shocked. Like I said, even the sound, the photography, and now that I know DuBont was a photography guy, it makes sense. That was a beautiful movie. So I appreciated that more. The actual story between Bill and Joe made sense from the start to the finish. And
yeah.
I wasn't bothered by their scenes. They had a natural build up to coming back. You knew they were coming back together since the start of the movie. Because as soon as you saw Jamie Gertz's big hair, you knew she was out of it.
She's there to get down.
Yeah. And by the time they ended it, you know, a little sappy, but yeah, it made sense. And I just saw the twister scenes as what they were, set pieces and advanced next scene. And I've seen so many of these wacky side characters by this point. You know, since 96, we've seen this in other movies. We've seen the Josh Whedon and J.J. Abrams kind of dialogue that now I look at it, I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, this is typical. And it just rolls off my back. So this time when I saw it, I gave it an extra half star. I gave it a 3 stars.
Fair assessment. All right. Well, there you go. So that's where we stand. This was fun. So if you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, and we'll try to put out as much content as we can. Before we want to leave, just a couple recommendations. We want to leave you with, you know, stuff we're currently watching or enjoying. So, you know, I would recommend, there's a couple podcasts I listen to. One is called Destroy All Movies. It's a great, really the template for this show. A couple of guys do a great version where they just kind of barbecue some sacred cows on our favorite movies. They're a great listen. And if you're looking for something to watch, there's a show on Hulu called Letterkenny, which I highly recommend. It's a Canadian show about small-time life. It's one of those that's it's so lowbrow, it's highbrow. It's a great 20-minute show to watch when you got nothing else to do, so I would recommend watching those guys. Mike, what do you watch?
As far as a podcast or like video, I watch the YouTube. Red Letter Media does a great little show they call Review, where they go back to kind of like we're doing here today. I would go back to a movie, look at it again for the second time, third time even, and just kind of say, hey, why did we like this or why did we hate this?
Yeah.
That's good. That's a good thing to watch. I don't watch a lot of TV anymore. I watch a lot of old movies. But I'm waiting for 1899 to come out on Netflix. I don't know when it's coming out. I'm checking it every day. Just stunned by the producers of Dark, which I loved.
Yeah.
It looks like a great show, and everybody's waiting for it to come out. So that would be me, too.
All right, good stuff. Okay, so thanks for listening. You can check us out on Instagram at Grumpy Nostalgia. And if you got some comments about all of our brilliant observations, you can leave those at grumpynostalgia@gmail.com. So that'll wrap it up today. So thanks, for everybody, for listening, and we'll see you again next time.